step inside the tribe as our market experts share their boots-on-the-ground experience from the front lines of freight tech's emergence. I'm Tim Dooner, and this is Freight Waves Insiders. Welcome back to the show where we go inside the career journeys and brand stories of the people who make freight happen. Joining me today is Felipe Capella. He's the co-founder and co-CEO at LoadSmart. And you know what? You know who else has a co-CEO, Felipe? Netflix.
Yeah, we're going there, man. It's our next step in freight. It's going to be a live truck streaming.
Yeah, that's a good question now. Like, what would the Netflix of freight be? We have FreightWaves TV. I guess that could kind of be it.
Yeah, you just have to get your stocks together and hope for the best.
Yeah, we need our own Squid Game. I mean, that show is just blowing up everywhere. For those who are not familiar, though, they may not have, like, you were on What the Truck about a year ago. It was a great appearance. And when I talked to you then, I was like, man, I need to have more time to sit down with Felipe. But for those who may have missed that episode or LoadSmart just hasn't got on their radar yet, what's the elevator pitch on what you and the team do?
Yeah, no, that first and foremost, I remember you gave me 60 seconds. I prepared like for days and I came to your show and I was 58 seconds and you kicked me out. So, but I'm back here now. So I can give you the elevator pitch about LoadSmart. So we are a freight tech company, right? And we operate as a digital freight broker. So we take principal risk towards shippers. We produce instant pricing, instant booking experience for shippers. Provide our rates via API inside the TMSs and move the load in a very automated way. So operating since 2014, 2015, so 7 years in this journey and super excited about the next few weeks.
It's the second week of October when we're recording this in 2021. Crazy time in shipping. What would be on the co-CEO, co-founder of LoadSmart's desk this week? What are you trying to fight through?
That's interesting. I think if you take a look at what has been happening in the past, I would say 3 years, right? So it's very funny because people, especially the youngest ones among us, they believe everything is in the cloud and has always been in the cloud. And that's not true for logistics, right? Especially for trucking. So if you go to 2018, was really the year that shippers started to migrate to the cloud. Before the 2018, all the major TMSs were all on-premise, right? Were like softwares installed in hardware computers somewhere in a floor in a big building, right? Then from 2018, all the major TMSs started to migrate to the cloud. So what we have been seeing in this past 3 years is that a huge adoption of cloud-based solutions by enterprise accounts. So we kept our focus on building our API integrations and connecting with these large shippers. And this is just increasing month over month and quarter over quarter. I'll give you one data point that is very interesting. Currently, actually last year, Q2 last year, through our API integrations, we had seen $400 million of freight opportunity in a quarter. Q2 this year, we saw $2 billion of freight opportunity via API connections. So really focusing on keep growing our API, becoming a bit more sophisticated on how we partner up with the shippers in order to allow them to get a lot of value out of our API infrastructure as well, and our data analytics that we plug into that. And also, I think 2020 and 2021, we're finally seeing carriers starting to migrate to the cloud as well. So moving away from spreadsheets and start to adopt this load planning solutions in the cloud and carrier ERP systems. And we're very excited because finally, we're going to have demand and supply in the cloud, and we can finally tackle these huge industry inefficiencies.
Yeah, it's like carriers don't just, you know, it's not even telling them to get into the future anymore. It's like get into the present. Every stakeholder's trying to go digital now and trying to make this whole operation a little bit more seamless. Speaking of operations, so a big, like I remember we did one of our virtual events about a year ago, and one of the guests on there, he was talking about the death of industrial real estate, right? And office space are going to be gone and everyone's going to be work from home. However, I'm looking at this press release right here and it says you just moved into a 35,000 square foot location in Chicago. So maybe that call was a little premature.
Yeah, by the way, I was not the one making that call, was?
No, it was not you.
Yeah, just to clarify. Yeah, absolutely. I have never believed that that theory, what I think it is interesting is a more hybrid workspace, right? Allowing people to work a few days from home and then coming a few days to work. That I think is a best or a much better framework than having this obligation of showing up at work every single day. So that I think was a step for the better. But I do believe there's a lot of a benefit of being under the same roof at least a few days a week, right? This kind of occasional encounters over the kitchen or like a water cooler in which you can just like exchange some information. People raise issues, right? Hey, I've noticed that we're doing this way. I think we could be doing this another way, just like passing by, you know? And so this presence in person adds value as well. So again, we're moving towards this more hybrid workspace, and super happy to have this new space in which we can accommodate probably 200 and something people.
Yeah, I mean, I'm living in that hybrid world now too. I mean, I have to go into film shows and stuff, but I know that when I'm, you know, and I was in sales before, so I'm used to working alone, but what happens is you lose touch with people after a while. And it's one thing I noticed at Freeway's rapid growth startup is we hired maybe, I don't know, 100 some odd people during the pandemic. And there's all these people on Slack and everything that I've never met before. I have no idea who they were. And you lose a little bit of that tribal culture at times when you're not, when you don't have these opportunities to convene, like you're speaking here. Is that something that you were seeing also?
Absolutely. And remember, like, human beings are social animals, right? We need human interaction. So I felt that myself, like staying home every single day and you do not have the separation between work and your own home. So sometimes you're working and you lose a sense of time. It's not very healthy as well. So I think there's a better mix in having kind of these few days at home, few days at work is a good balance. You see people, you interact, but sometimes also you have to deal with something at your own home. You have this flexibility to work from your apartment. It's a better mix for sure.
I think the other thing too that happens just before we move off this topic is when you work at home for an extended period of time and you don't know someone, you don't really know how to read their messaging, especially in freight when you're in or media where you're in a very fast paced environment. Sometimes it can seem like you're being short or curt with someone when you're really just trying to kick the can down the road. And because you haven't had that chance to have that personal relationship, I think sometimes, you know, it can ring kind of hollow, and it's important to have that so people understand the voice that's coming at them instead of our own head. You know, a lot of times our own moods tend to filter the way we perceive things.
Yeah, and again, to the social animals that we are, we analyze, although we don't do that consciously, but we analyze small facial cues, right, and voice intonation much better when we're in person, so we can have a better reading of the situation and how people are feeling once you have this like personal contact. So I'm with
Felipe. Let's go back in time. Let's find out where you came from. You're 16 years old, right? You're thinking about life, maybe a little bit. And you know, the U.S., we're usually starting to look at colleges, start scouting. We generally don't have an idea what we're doing. I believe you may have been in Brazil at this time. What was 16-year-old Felipe like? What did you want to do with your life?
Oh, my God. Like, yeah, I think I evolved a bit. But 16 years old, as you can tell by my weird accent, I'm from Brazil, right? So 16, 17, my father was trying to convince me to be a lawyer. And in Brazil, we do not have this concept of like a four-year college in which you take a bunch of mixed courses and mixed subjects, right? And then you make a better decision if you're going to go to graduate school. In Brazil, it's kind of all or nothing. When you're 17, you have to make a decision, I'm going to be a lawyer, and then you go to 5 years of law school straight, right? Or 4 years of business school or 6 or 7 years of medical school. So it's kind of direct, again, all or nothing. So my father convinced me to be a lawyer. My brother was a lawyer. So I went through the same path, went to law school, graduated. For some weird reason, I started my own law firm, which I'm not sure was the wisest decision ever. with 22 years old, trying to convince your customers that you know something. I was starting to teach law at the Federal University at 25. Then at 27, I got a scholarship from the Spanish government for a master's degree. So I moved to Madrid, spent a year there. Then 1 year later, I came to the U.S. to the University of Pennsylvania, another master's degree. And then I graduated and I got an offer from a law firm in New York City called Sullivan & Cromwell to join their practice, the corporate practice. So I went there, practiced for a couple of years, M&A, then moved to Washington, D.C. to join the Inter-American Development Bank, focus on infrastructure projects for Latin America, hospital buildings, road transportation as well. And then met Ricardo, who's my business partner. And then he's smarter than I am. So he identified there was a huge opportunity in trucking in the U.S. And after like 12 years of in this corporate world, I thought it was a great opportunity to jump out and get into something more interesting, which was trucking plus technology.
Wow. Well, that's a lot to go through. And now I'm curious about a couple things here. One is being like the Brazilian Better Call Saul. My perception of boots on the ground Brazil is more from movies, but from Brazilian people. Actually, when I was working at FedEx Trade Networks in East Boston, there's a large Brazilian population there, and about four of the brokers, the customs house brokers I work with, they were all Brazilian dudes. One of them was this guy Havlin. I should reach out to him. I've spoken to him in too long, but that's an interesting pathway. So, what was law like in Brazil? It sounded like it was a challenge, and you obviously realized you needed more schooling.
Law in Brazil, it's a bit different from the U.S. because it's all a federal, right? So, although we do have like state laws and city laws, it's not as federalized as the U.S. And also, you have to understand that Brazil, you have like five countries within, right? Not that dissimilar from, I don't know, either India or China, in which regional differences are really really big. So it really depends where you live and where you go. You have a very different experience of life, safety, and so forth and so on. I was lucky to be born in a place which is a bit more safe and in the south of Brazil. But when I was 27, 28, I was helping U.S. companies to invest in real estate in the south. Then I thought there was an opportunity to expand my knowledge of U.S. law, as I was dealing a lot with U.S. Customers, again, investing in Brazil. So I think that was kind of the link that I made in my mind, or at least the mental justification that I gave to myself to go to the U.S., right? And everyone sees the U.S. as kind of the top of the professional career, especially in New York City when it comes to law and finance, right? So I think that was what I was thinking as well. If I end up in the U.S. Practicing law, it's kind of...
Well, you Penn, too. I mean, you must have been ecstatic when you were there. You're like, I've made it. I've made it to UPenn, so much so that your colleagues granted you the funniest person there award. Did you like, were you just glowing when you got to America? What was going on, Felipe?
Yeah, that was interesting. As you can tell right now, I'm not that funny anymore. But back then maybe I was a bit. And I was super happy when I got to the U.S. Again, I always had the dream of attending a top university, and it was really really interesting, especially for the quality of my colleagues, right? And I've seen people, remember, around the world, these guys were speaking like four, five, six languages, and I thought to myself, these guys are much smarter than I am. I really have to catch up. So it was an amazing experience. And a great year spent in the great city of Philadelphia.
Well, I mean, the good news is that you're already on a higher plateau than many of us Americans like myself that can barely speak one language. So you have that going for you. Now, you were in law, right? If you wanted to get into logistics, you could have like sued trucking companies and stuff for getting into accidents. You could have been a part of these nuclear verdicts and all of these things. How did that diversion from law come about? You mentioned meeting a business partner.
Yeah, absolutely. So I met Ricardo, who also has this Latin name because he's an American Colombian. But he actually lived his whole life in the U.S. He graduated from Georgia Tech in engineering, and then he joined Goldman Sachs early in the day. So he spent 13 years at Goldman Sachs. And over there, he participated in a lot of logistics and trucking transactions. So he saw very closely the inefficiencies of the industry. He participated in the YRC restructuring, if you remember back in the days. So he saw like this is really an industry that was kind of left behind in this technology revolution. I think right now the most exciting place to be is logistics or healthcare in terms of technology and how this thing, how things are moving fast in massive industries, and industries plagued again with a lot of inefficiency. If you take a look at, for example, Jim, like I don't know, food delivery or travel bookings, we used to do these things very differently like 10 years ago, right? We used to go to travel agencies. There was no price transparency. You could not book anything online. And in like 15 years of transition, now you have these five or six major platforms that you can just book a hotel or compare prices for flight tickets in two or three clicks online, right? So again, 15 years was not overnight. Food delivery was the same thing. Like all the restaurants, remember, were out of the cloud, right? They were just like mom and pop shops, a very scattered number of restaurants around the U.S. And it was a journey for them to adopt a cloud-based solution to manage their own inventory and their own menus, right? That's necessary for you to provide this instant experience of delivery. But 12 years later, tech companies that were tackling that issue are now worth $100 billion in the food delivery. If you take a look at travel bookings, tech companies are now worth, depending if you add Airbnb or not, but I think if you add Airbnb, probably $300 billion. And guess what? Trucking is an industry that is bigger than travel bookings and food delivery combined in the U.S., right? So, and if you sum up all the billion-dollar tech companies that now are starting to pop up more often, you still see probably, if you sum them up, less than $10 billion. I think, and I have some bets out there about that. I think in the next 3 years, you're going to see at least five companies that are going to be worth more than $10 billion in freight tech in the U.S.
Okay, so some Deca unicorns on the horizon, and you know that M&A space. So I wanted to ask you, what did being in M&A teach you about logistics? I guess it taught you a bit about just the existence of companies, right, and where the tech was at. But did you learn anything else about launching a company, or when did this idea for LoadSmart start to percolate inside you?
Yeah, in M&A, I've learned that you have no weekends off. That's what I think was the first lesson that I learned. But you learned a lot by being surrounded with very smart people. I think I think Ricardo and I took that from our previous lives. Him at Goldman, and I came from this corporate world. And again, things are done very differently in banks and law firms. But one thing that you see is that being surrounded by very smart people with expertise in what they're doing is very, very right. And I can tell you like a mistake that we have done when we started a company. We consider ourselves the true like geeks of logistics in the US. Since we started in 2014, we have had around 35% to 40% of our employees tech guys, right? Like the software engineers, very different from other peers. And it's still true today that around at least a third of our team are tech guys. But at the beginning, it was a bit too much. And it took us a while to understand that we needed a lot of very smart and knowledgeable people from logistics, right? With expertise in logistics that we did not have, right? Ricardo and I came from out of industry with some naive thoughts about some things. And then it took us a while to recognize, hey, we need some very smart people from logistics with a lot of logistics experience, because this is a logistics business at the end of the day, right? So, and I think we, especially in the past 3 years, we have really corrected for that. We hired amazing people with a lot of experience across the board in logistics. So nowadays, having a much more balanced team between tech and logistics and trying to help our customers and our other players to tackle optimization problems.
Now, is that launch vision that you had in 2014, how different is LoadSmart now from what you thought it would be? I mean, the most interesting thing about startups to me is some of the pivots that they make and how they were almost completely different companies at the start. And FreightWaves itself is not immune from that. We were in a completely different direction, and that changed over the course of time.
No, absolutely. We see like every couple of years, it changed a bit. Right, you realize that you learn some things. You're like, oh, I was wrong with this assumption. There's another opportunity there, so you shifted a bit. What I can say is that when we came, and again, Ricardo and I came with some naive thoughts, but also some good ones as well from out of industry. The first things that we looked at how people were again booking flights, right, in orbits or Priceline, is like, hey, why can't logistics work in a similar fashion? Why do you have to have all these phone calls and emails to try to get a quote and book a shipment, right? From an enterprise perspective. And then we realized very quickly why was that the case, because if your orbits, right, when if you go to orbits or Priceline, whatever, you go there and say, like, I want a flight ticket from New York to Los Angeles, what they do is that they look at their supply side, and their supply is what, 15, 20 airlines, billion-dollar companies, very sophisticated, right? They know exactly what planes are departing from where. They know where the planes are going to, what days. They know what seats are available, right? They have a pricing engine that they run, and they just send the price back to Orbitz via API, and the and Orbitz just displays that back to you on your screen. So what Orbitz does, receives the request, pings their supply, receive the data from the supply, and display back to you. That's beautiful. When we try to do the same in our business, when we receive the request from the shipper, and when we look at our supply side, we didn't see 10, 15, 20 billion dollar companies sophisticated, right? We saw 275,000 carriers, 96% of them with less than 10 trucks, and pretty much all of them working out of spreadsheets and out of the cloud. So the first decision that we made is that, okay, we cannot have instant pricing coming from our supply side. So let's hack it. Let's create our own pricing. Let's create a pricing algorithm that tries to predict how much is going to cost us in the supply side, in the trucking market, to move a specific load. And let's stand behind that pricing. Let's become what they call market makers, right? So, and people called us crazy. That was 2015. People called us crazy because they said freight brokers are not supposed to take the risk of the transaction, right? Freight brokers are like real estate brokers. You don't take risk, right? And we disagreed. We thought, like, no, we think there's a it's a good way to tackle the inefficiencies in this industry. We're going to lose some money here and there because the algorithm's not going to be right all the time. But we're going to learn, we're going to improve, and we're going to do two things. We're going to provide an instant experience to the shipper. We're going to populate this rate automatically inside the shipper's TMS so they don't have to call anyone, right? And second, that's a huge distribution model for us. Instead of having a bunch of people calling shippers and calling carriers to get rates and offer rates here and there, remember, like CH has what, like 12,000 people? Mm-hmm. Half of these guys are on the phone the whole day. Right. And we're going to do this via algorithms and APIs. And I think we were right. The place that we were wrong is that our API was done in 2016, late 2016. And I remember having a fight with our engineering team that they thought we didn't have a user case. I was like, no, this is the future. You guys have to build this. And then we were calling TMSs back in 2016 saying, like, hey, we have this amazing thing. It's going to be amazing for your shippers. They don't have to go outside from your TMS anymore, because we're going to populate our rates inside your system. It's amazing. And they're like, wow, that's actually pretty cool. Yes, but our systems are all analog. We're out of the cloud. It's going to take us a year and a half to integrate. It's going to cost us $1 million. We cannot do it. So from 2016 to 2018, we suffered a lot because we had all this technology and we couldn't integrate with the TMS. So we were just providing the prices in our website. But our website is really for small customers, right? If you're a large customer, like whatever, Walmart, Starbucks, Home Depot, you're trading volumes. You don't want to go to a website and quote load after load. So again, very tough year, 16 to 18. And then 2018, when TMS started to migrate to the cloud and we could finally integrate with these guys, then we started to see the flywheel and all these transactions being done via API. Currently around 87% of our revenues are fully automated in this quote and book flow.
Ooh, well, that's not bad at all. You know, a lot of interesting things were said there too, and I'm trying to put myself in your position as you, because I know that you've been very hands-on. I think since the beginning you've built this product or had a big part in building this product. But at the same time, you're kind of learning freight and trucking as you're building this thing. How much of a challenge did your own limitations at the time present for you?
Yeah, that was, it was actually, this is actually very interesting. If I, Ricardo and I always talk nowadays, like if we had to start again, we would do so many things different. That's why, venture capital companies invest a lot in second time entrepreneurs, because you learn so much by making a lot of mistakes, right? So unfortunately, I have to apologize to our investors that we did make a lot of mistakes at the beginning. Right. Again, especially because we did not have the logistics. I have to say that openly and transparently out there. And but then we caught up. Right. We hired a bunch of guys with a lot of experience that could teach us about the industry, about how these things work, and nuances that we were unaware of, right? And again, nowadays, I think we have a pretty good, healthy mix of technology and logistics, and that's who we are today.
Yeah, and that freight component is, and that's why it's always going to be so hard to completely remove that sort of tribal knowledge from a team, because there's such a vernacular used in this business. It's you know, it's our own, it sounds like English, but it's our own dialogue and our own language and our own acronyms. Oh,
it's complex.
Oh, and sure.
It's very complex, right? Also, people that come from out of industry, and that includes investors, they do not realize how complex these things are, right? And we're seeing that right now with all this this mess in supply chain, that supply chain is, first of all, by definition, not very flexible, right? Because you move physical goods. And second, because it has been a late adopter of technology that harms your adaptability. When COVID hit and consumer habits changed dramatically, right? You had a pretty much a stop in service spending, and then people created disposable income and start to buy stuff, right? And then it's very difficult for supply chain to adapt to high levels of variability once you have like analog things. But I agree with you, like, it's again very, very complex. That's why I think this transition to technology, right, is not a sprint, right? Like, I think it started like kind of 18 with all the migrations of TMS to the cloud, but we still have a good, like, probably 7 years to go. Again, yes, it has already happened with other industries. Travel bookings took 15 years, right? Food delivery took 12 years. So I'm projecting here that this is going to take 10 years, starting 2018-ish. So we kind of 3 years in, we have another good 7 years to go. And I think the way that we're growing the company has been super pragmatic. We don't lose money. We don't think that's a good strategy. We never believed in this theory of growing very fast by subsidizing shippers, and with this theory that you would build enough volume and then some quote unquote network effects would appear magically and then you would justify everything. We never believed that. We made the same calculations and we reached a different conclusion that these losses were too big to justify an incremental efficiency gain. We think huge network effects only come once supply and demand move, and the demand started to move to the cloud 2018, and supply is now moving to the cloud 2021, right? So we have been doing this in a very different pragmatic way, and doing this slowly and building technology and products with this 10-year journey.
So, you know, the pandemic has been a massive inflection point for freight tech. And I remember talking to Craig Fuller, our CEO and founder over here at FreightWaves. And this was back maybe December of 2019. I remember we were going out to raise another round. And he was coming back from California, like, so defeated, because he was meeting with these VCs and the WeWork had just happened. So money had kind of dried up. Nobody was really looking to invest in that moment. Then we had the pandemic, right? And then everything looked like it was going to go to hell. But by June of last year, all of a sudden, I think that, you know, venture capitalists started to realize, oh, all these supply chains are starting to digitize. Freight tech is hot. And especially this year, there's been just so much money flowing into all of these different deals. Have you seen a lot more adoption during this pandemic?
Yeah, absolutely. I think COVID pushed a lot, especially the shipper side, to adopt technology, right? Transportation, especially large companies, has traditionally been seen as a cost center, right, that people have to deal with. And but now they realize it's actually a vital pillar of each company. And if you're not digital, you cannot automate. And if you cannot automate, you cannot build efficiencies. And you're not nimble, right? So in 2020, to give you an example, 2020, we saw more API integrations with our quoting book architecture than in the whole past 3 years. Right. So people are realizing, and I agree with you. And actually, this is probably one of my predictions for this year, that half right, that this year we would see also a lot of M&A opportunities being executed. Right. Because, again, the market is so fragmented. There's an opportunity for consolidation, and different people are solving different problems that sometimes when they put them together have double the efficiency. So I think, as I mentioned, like, this is, I think, the right time to be in logistics. I think it's even, to be honest with you, a bit too much. When I look at Series A companies right now, they're raising $15 million. That was unthinkable like 3 years ago, right? If you raise $15 million Series A, it means that your valuations are like $50, $60, $70 million Series A. It means that you probably do not have a product yet. And sometimes you're pre-revenue. So people are now running some risks out there. And that's going to be interesting to see what happens in the 12 months from now, that these companies have to generate something with this $15 million. But again, there's a journey in this entrepreneurship, right? If you had put like $20 million on day one that I was starting LoadSmart, it would probably not be very well spent because you have to learn things, right? And so there's a cautionary tale there. And let's see what happens in the next 12 months.
Well, I mean, you and your team have done a pretty decent job, right? You're in your Series C round, if I'm not mistaken. You've raised a close to $150 million, if I'm not wrong. How have those rounds gone? And are you looking to go out to another round? What are the plans in that arena?
Is this like, should I pay you like a percentage fee if I say something here and I ended up raising money? Or it's not, no? It's like, okay. Yeah, we raised total so far. We raised $140 million. So we've burned like $90 million in 7 years. Most of it focused on tech development. But again, very different from some of our peers. Some of them has burned $90 million in 2 quarters, right? Like subsidizing shippers, and that's not what we have done. So again, we have a lot of cash still with us. We fundraised last year our Series C led by BlackRock, and TFI joined the round. So we are okay. But of course, the market is very hot. Do we get calls from and emails from investors? Yes. Yeah, and we analyze them as they.
Well, I'm rooting for you guys. You know, I talk to a lot of founders on this show, and there's usually two sort of types. There's like this serial startup entrepreneur, and like within 3 to 5 years, they're out the door because it starts to get too structured, too corporate, right? You start having an HR department, things like that. That type of founder doesn't tend to like it anymore. They want to do something else. But you've been with LoadSmart for over 7 years now through 3 rounds. Are you in it for the long haul?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm with you. I've seen, and it's a lot to do with personality as well. Like I have a lot of respect for these guys that can take a business out of the ground. It's very, very difficult. Like the first 2 or 3 years are the most difficult. And the reason that I'm, the reason why I'm still around and I'm so excited is I think it's twofolded. First, the company changes so much, right? And so you're always learning something new. We have probably currently between direct and indirect employees, around 600 people. We onboarded 150 people in the past 4 months, right? Last year, At this point in time, we had 300 people. So and the year before we had 100 something. So managing a company with 100, 300 people is very different from managing a company with 600, right? So we just hire a CFO, we hire a chief people officer, then the way that you think about things change from like product development and be super obsessed about product to more like org design, right? And process design and who are the right people and what is the right organization structure. So it changes. It becomes like you keep learning, right? And again, that's the first reason. The learning continues. And the second one is that, again, I think this is a 10-year journey in this digitization. And I think we're in year 3-ish. So I think there's a huge, huge upside ahead. And I think people underestimate what's going to happen in the next 3 or 4 years. And I want to be here to see that through.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I think that if you ask people maybe in 2015 what the real hot tech in like freight tech would be in 5-6 years, they would probably be like autonomous trucks. Autonomous trucks are going to be everywhere. And I think that You know, I was talking to Bill Driegert from Uber Freight recently, and he was with like Otto there, and he was there at the beginning when Uber Freight was trying to be more of an autonomous player, right? They wanted all those trucks to be automated, and they realized pretty quickly that that tech is still a long way off, especially when you're talking about over the road, and especially when you're talking about the, like, you're talking about a digital load board here, right? Or putting loads on there. And there's already the inherent challenge of getting enough information just in that booking so that all parties need to know what to do. And then you just completely remove a driver and you make that completely automated. It is such a, I don't know, I'm kind of short right now on the at least long range autonomous truck market at the moment.
Yeah, it's much tougher than people thought, right? And that's probably true more often than not in this industry. I think things are moving forward. I'm excited about the Daimler and Waymo partnership. Daimler has been a close a partner of us, so I'm super excited about what they're building and how they're building it. But it's going to take a while. It's going to take a while. It's not going to be tomorrow. It's not going to be next two or three years, right? And remember, the U.S. fleet is actually quite big, right? So in order to replace that fleet, in order to replace the way that these trucks move around, it's going to be a different framework. You're going to have an operator / maintenance fleet provider. It's not going to happen overnight. It's going to take probably another, 15 years. In order for that to be a representative of some scale. I'm more excited about tackling inefficiencies via data and via all these players moving to the cloud, right? And it's interesting. We had a project yesterday that we're finally, in this past 6 to 9 months, starting to receive real-time actual capacity data. And not where the truck is today, because that's not really that much interesting, but where the truck is going to be in 4 days and what load this truck is moving and who's driving that truck and how many hours that the driver has left and where this truck needs to go next. That's the actual data that makes it very exciting, because then I look at this $2 billion of freight that I see on the demand side and I can really try to find the best load for that that truck. And sometimes if I hit on the nail, the deadhead goes to zero. Or goes to 1 or 2 or 3 or 5 miles, right? In the U.S., I think there's like $100 billion of deadhead inefficiency. So now that the supply is migrating to the cloud, I think it's a much lower hanging fruit, a much larger optimization potential than obsessing about
Now, optimization has come under fire a little bit when this discussion of the shipping crisis comes up, because people go, well, you know, it's this just-in-time environment that's put us here, and you know, the more optimized you get, the more fragile you get in a black swan situation, and then we are where we are now. But is that kind of misguided, that thinking?
Yeah, I'm not sure what the thinking is behind. Like, the more optimized you are, the fragile you are. I'm not sure where that's coming from. If you're talking about just in time, yeah, it's a just in time. People forgot that just in time inventory management it comes with pros and cons, right? once you have disruptions in the supply chain, you're going to be out of inventory. So I think people relied a bit too much and they forgot about the risks of doing just in time. It's a strategy that has to be wisely used and at some discretion. Not just adopted because it was in a nice business class that you took once, you know. So that I agree with. I think it was kind of just in time was a bit too widely used and people forgot about the risks. But I think it's actually when it comes to technology and optimization, I think it's the contrary, right? I think optimization allows you to try to predict what's going to go wrong a week from. And I think that's also a big dispute that I have with some of the visibility players that they claim they're adding a lot of value, providing visibility. And I think visibility is nothing without action or without execution, right? Visibility only adds value once you can fix something and you can actually do something about it, right? So I think people have to keep that in mind when they select technologies or select the project that they want to implement at their companies. Like, how is that going to really help you in terms of bottom line, right? Is that going to improve your on-time delivery? Is that going to save you money? And sometimes I think people forget that you actually having the data is not enough. You have to actually fix it, right? Which is kind of, more often than not, is a logistics execution.
I got to agree with you. You know, all the port truckers, all the dray drivers, they were, you know, the hornet's nest got kicked and has been kicked recently because as the White House gets involved, right? And as the mainstream press gets involved, there's this big talk of driver shortages going on, and that's why, and it's warehouses, that's why, and there's all these different reasons why we're in the crisis that we're in at the ports. But all the dray drivers are like, look, one of the biggest problems here has to do with technology. The appointment system is fundamentally broken. And when you say there's not enough truck drivers, I'm in a line 2 mile long of trucks trying to get in and out. It's like trying to tell someone that, you know, you're filling a bottle with water and it starts overflowing. You're saying, add more water to it, right? And I think that the driver's like, well, we need a bigger bottle or a more efficient one. What have the ports been like from at least LoadSmart's perspective?
Yeah, Ports America is one of our investors. They joined our, if I remember well, our Series B in 2018. And we have been developing for the past 2 years a project with them in order to completely change how containers move through the port. So currently, as you know, the way that it happens is that the truck driver shows up at the port and they say like, hey, I came here to pick up container 123. And when they realize container 123 is in the last pile, at the bottom of a pile of five containers, right? So it's a mess to kind of try to shuffle. And now we're trying to see that, okay, having all the data centralized in one place, can the port tell the truck driver which is the best container for the truck driver to pick up? The one that is at the top of the pile is closest to where the truck driver is, and try to reduce 30 to 40%. The speed or the truck turn time. And it's been like two tough years developing that stuff because it's not easy. Now we have to have the real-time location of the crane, because the crane actually plays a part into that as well. If the crane is far away, it may take 3 or 4 or 5 minutes for the crane to reach the other side of the port, right? So it's a very, very complex problem. And we're hopefully launching something within the next 6 months in order to address that. But I agree with you that maybe port terminals could have done something a bit earlier than waiting for a pandemic to happen. But I've heard that in the West Coast also, there are some interesting projects being done by other players to try to tackle that. But I am with you. I think there's a huge inefficiency in how containers move through the port and how trucks pick them up. And the appointment system is bad. That's why, like, these things, I think, if you think about that, how much inefficiency do you think there's there? Like $30, $40, $50 billion of inefficiency.
A ton.
Yeah.
Right. So I mean, there's a ton.
That's the interesting part. Yeah.
Because, I mean, all the drivers, too. I mean, you think of all the drivers who are tied up, and if they're there for, you know, 2 to 12 hours, and it depends on the port. You know, the New Jersey guys, the New York guys, the L.A. guys, they have the biggest complaints. Charleston's getting pretty bad, though. I actually know a couple steamship lines have started to divert out of Charleston just because that's getting congested as well. And maybe they're being a little bit more, I don't know, proactive. It's sometimes weird, you know, when you're in supply chain and you know, you and I have our boots in the mud, and then like it finally gets into the mainstream press. But this has been like an issue that's been going on since, I don't know, May or June of 2020. So, I mean, it's great that some action is being taken, but this has been a problem for a while, and it's just been mounting on top of each other. And we've waited until peak season to like really make it this big issue.
Yeah, absolutely. That's again, but that's why we're here now, right? I think, it's exciting times. I want to look at it from a positive angle, that there is so much money being invested in technology companies in logistics, and some of them are going to fail, but some of them are going to succeed. And when they succeed, they improve the whole industry, right? And it's better for everyone, because again, remember, and I think people forget about this thing, that inefficiencies in the industry are not, no one loses when you tackle it. It's actually a win-win for everyone. So if you can decrease the truck time at the port thinks it's better because they're in the business of actually moving containers through the port. That's their business. That's how they make money. So they're happy to move more containers. The truck driver is happy because he can pick up more containers in a day, right? The shipper is happy because he gets to retrieve the container faster. It does not have to pay the demurrage and so forth and so on. So it's a win-win for everyone. It's great, right? So no one has to lose. So people should embrace a bit more that the technology is not here to steal anyone's And your standard is a lot of times it just adds value across the board.
Now, one thing it seemed like you recognized from the beginning is, you know, you mentioned Orbitz, and Orbitz is all about user experience, right? Uber is about user experience. I open up this app and the car is going to come, right? And I know what's going to happen. Orbitz, I know that I click on the plane ticket. I know it's going to get booked. I know they're going to send me my pass. I trust in it. It's part of the brand. You guys very much the same, but we're in a situation now, we're in this pandemic where capacity has been very tight, deliveries have been delayed, those kind of things. What have been your customers' biggest challenge throughout all this that you've had to solve?
That's a good question. I think on the shipper side is just this change in the demand profile, right? That no one was prepared for. And they saw a lot of disruptions in their planning. So they had a certain budget, right? That got completely thrown out of the window. They had a certain expectation for contracts. They're seeing as you know through the freight waves around what 20%+ of rejection rates currently in the market. So that throws a lot of problems they're planning. So I think what shippers want right now is to go back to a more planned supply chain, right? At least on the transportation side. How can we go back to take control of things and being able to plan ahead and execute? One of the things that we're doing with shippers and has been quite difficult, and it's not only us, I think some of our peers as well, it's difficult because it demands change in behavior and human beings are like old habits. We're trying to tell shippers that there are better ways of agreeing on certain contracts than they're currently. These kind of fake contracts that the industry has, right? That they people promise that they're going to move the load for a certain rate, but whatever, if the market changes one way or the other, either the broker or the carrier complains or the shipper complains back, so it's not a real contract, right? It's not the best way of doing it. It's quite obvious for everyone. There are much smarter ways that you can have a contract together that's kind of binding and allows them to plan in advance. Right now, we're pushing ahead what we're calling reliable contracts. We're trying to tell these guys, hey, let's agree on a target rate for a specific lane, right? We guarantee 100% of acceptance, right? And the closer we get to your target rate, the higher our margin is. And the far away we get from that rate, the lower our margin is. So we're super, super incentivized to source well. We have the same target rate in mind, and you have 100% PTA acceptance. That should be a no-brainer, right? But to change the way people do things that they have been doing for the past 20 years is actually quite difficult.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, I got to ask you something then. So it's been such an interesting market, and it's an interesting time, and it's really hard to make predictions, right? Everyone's trying to make predictions, but 5 years from now, where you think that your Load Smart's still the same thing? You think you're still with Load Smart? What do you see yourself 5 years from now?
In Thailand, uh-huh. South of Thailand.
Oh, why? Why Thailand?
I'm kidding. 5 years from now, okay. 5 years from now, that's a good question. I think if we take a look at our projections and where we want to be, I think the natural path will probably be an IPO, right? Because as you become bigger, strategic access do not make sense anymore. So we're probably going to IPO the company at some point in the future and keep growing it, right? At a certain point, we're going to have to hire an adult CEO to run the business, right? And so that I see that happening in sometime in the future. For now, I'm having fun, and again, I think there's a huge. I'm super excited about the opportunities in the industry. I think again, is the right industry to be together with healthcare. So guys, if you're 18, 19, 20, you're listening to me, forget about this college stuff and join a logistics startup. It's much more fun. Okay. says the guy with like three degrees, you know. I'm super excited. I think again, it's just the beginning of the next 5 or 6 years of the next 5 or 6 years of this 10-year digital transition, and I think there's a huge upside for the company. I'm still, again, as I mentioned, I'm still learning a lot, And at the right time, again, we're going to hire our Eric Schmidt to be the adult in the room.
You know, I mean, there's still tons and tons of brokers and companies out there that, as you mentioned, they have entire rooms full of people who are on phones all day. All they're doing is just calling the same numbers over and over again, trying to reach 275,000 carriers. And one of the ones I interviewed, they actually had like a gong in the room. Like if you actually got like someone, you'd hit the gong. I realized that was not for me, even though I hit a cowbell. But how many rocks do you think there's left to turn over of these 275,000 carriers that could be out there that you need to digitize and you want to suck into your LoadSmart network?
Well, I think most of them are still a bit far away from adopting, again, these load planning solutions. And the funny thing, right, if you think about carriers, the way that they operate today, you have this dispatcher that wakes up in the morning, goes to an office, opens the computer, and he opens 5-10 tabs, right? And he goes to like LoadSmart, load board, and goes to DAT, and goes to C.H. Robinson, and whatever else, other tabs that and then it manually tries to match the trucks that are running around the country with his loads that he manually sees in different tabs, right? This is crazy, right? Currently, for example, we are sending our loads via API to softwares and load planning solutions on the carrier side. And the softwares are matching the future truck locations with the loads that we're offering, right? This is much better for the carrier, right? The carrier does not have to do all this manual work. But of course, it requires changing things and changing behaviors, right? And but I think that's the future, right? The future is like decision-making on the carrier side being done within a load planning cloud-based solution. When it comes to brokers, it's very interesting as well. People have different ways of thinking about that. Currently, you have what, 17, 18, 19, 20,000 brokers in the US, right? And I agree with you, like 99% of them do not have a lot of technology. They either do things the old school way or they adopted an off-the-shelf a technology solution, maybe from a TMS. We have currently, I think our tech team is more than 150 people. So it's going to be very difficult for brokers, or for a lot of them at least, to compete with companies like us. They're dedicating hundreds of people focused on building technology every day. I think if you think about travel agency, right, how, again, before you also had thousands of travel agencies out there, I think a lot of people are going to recognize sometimes that if the margins go down too much, it's not worth it for them anymore to do the grinding every day. I think a lot of these guys are going to start partnering up with companies like us, right? But let's see. Let's see. But I think it is unlikely if we look at the business or the industry 5 years from now, it's quite unlikely to have 20,000.
Well, I just had you look ahead. And before I let you go, my last question to you is, you know, you've been doing this for 7.5 years at LoadSmart. You've been across several countries, multiple degrees on this earth for several decades as well. Look down from 30,000 feet and tell me what you see. Are you happy with everything that's going on? You love what you're looking down upon?
Absolutely. I'm having the time of my life. Again, as I mentioned, the toughest years, if you're going to start a company, the toughest years are probably the first two or three. Mm-hmm. So hang in there. This concept that you're going to build a technology company and in 6 months, you're going to build $1 billion. That does not happen, right? That's only in movies you see that kind of stuff. Usually it's a long grind. It's a lot of work, a lot of pain and suffering. I think Peter Thiel once mentioned that, maybe it was Peter Thiel, I don't know, once mentioned that building a company is kind of a chewing glass. That's probably true at the beginning. Right now, I think we found our place. We found a good product market fit. We're growing. Q2, we grew 230% year over year. Q3, we're going to be growing probably 100-something% year over year in terms of revenues. So we are, I think, the right place at the right time, and things are paying off. We're finally being vindicated with some of the strategies that we built 4 years ago. Now people are seeing that the way they were building this company was the right way, pragmatic, looking, building technology, looking at the future, deploying cash in a very disciplined way. And so super happy to be here and looking forward for the next three.
Well, cool. I'm happy for you, and I can hear it in your voice too. And for those who can't see, we can see each other. This is an audio only one, but I must compliment the beard you grew out for this particular episode too.
Yeah, I have to make this complaint because I thought this was a video interview, so I built all this, I groomed this huge beard. And that was all for nothing, Tim.
We'll have to get you on What the Truck soon to show the world. Folks out there, thank you for stepping inside our world today. Filippi, thank you for letting us go on this journey with you through your career and learning more about LoadSmart. And you know, I think we got some great advice, too, if you are a student or founder looking to get in this business or potential founder, go out there and take the lumps, right? It's part of the journey. It's part of the process. Maybe your first one won't be a success. Maybe it will. Filippi, your first one, 7.5 years, you've raised almost $150 million and you're still going strong. So, you know, it may hurt. It may be like chewing glass, but if you really want to do it and you get the passion, go after there, go and get it. If you want more episodes of FreightWaves Insiders to hear more founders and CEOs and people from across the industry like Filippi, look up FreightWaves Insiders wherever you get your podcasts. You want every FreightWaves podcast all on one feed? Look up FreightCast, full trail load of FreightWaves shows. You can find me on Twitter at Timothy Dooner, or if you'd like to be a guest, email me, tdooner@freightwaves.com. Hey, take care and God bless everybody.